You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Sally Layden had the support of dozens of loved ones as a coroner today confirmed what she's known all along.
Coroner's just told me officially my mum's deceased. So that's the first time I've heard that in 27 years.
Her mother, Marion Barter, disappeared in 1997 after changing her name, selling her house and quitting her job. She'd been dating a man named Rick Bloom who lied about his identity. Today, Coroner Teresa O'Sullivan found the pair travelled to the UK, returning without telling Marion's family. She found Bloom preyed on vulnerable women and withheld crucial information about Marion from the inquest. She also found New South Wales police bungled the missing persons investigation, recommending it now be referred to homicide detectives.
I haven't even had an apology, if I can put it out there. You know, I still haven't from the police had any apology for how I've been treated.
Today's findings mark the end of one fight and the beginning of another for Sally Layden. She's now determined to find out exactly how, when, where, and why her mother died, and plans to fly overseas in her search for answers.
It just doesn't stop just because we got an answer today from the coroner.
Jodie Lee, 7 News.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome back to Crime Analyst in the Intelligence Cell and my very special guests who are joining me today from Australia. Please go ahead and introduce yourself. You go first, Sally.
Hi, everybody. It's Sally Layden. Thank you for coming on and listening to our episode today.
And it's Joni Kondos here, along supporting Sally. Thank you very much.
Sitting
for
here
listening.
In Sydney together. It's yes. Very rare that we're together. Joni lives in Melbourne. I live in Brisbane, but we're in Sydney. So we thought we'd jump on together so Joni doesn't have to drive up and stand under the tower to get reception.
Yes.
Well, I appreciate that. And I feel very privileged to have you both in the same place at the same time and to be able to talk to you today. And I've been wanting to chat to you. You've been so busy since the coroner's findings on February the 29th. You've been doing your roadshows and it's been an incredibly busy time for you. I've now read through the 163-page or 168-page PDF report of the full findings. It's an extremely detailed report. And for my listeners who haven't read the report, and if you didn't attend the live streaming of the coroner's findings, I first want to read what the coroner, Teresa O'Sullivan, found and her recommendations. So under findings, I find on the balance of probabilities that Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly known as Marion Barter, is deceased. Identity. The person who died was Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly known as Marion Barter. Date of death. While I'm unable to determine the exact date of death, I find that Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly known as Marion Barter, is likely to have died on a date after the 15th of October, 1997. Place of death. I'm unable to determine the place of Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly Marion Barter's death. Cause of death. I am unable to determine the cause of Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly Marion Barter's death. Manner of death. I am unable to determine the manner of Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly Marion Barter's death. Recommendations. To the New South Wales Commissioner of Police. I recommend that the New South Wales Commissioner of Police cause the investigation into the death of missing person Florabella Natalia Marion Remickel, formerly known as Marion Barter, to be referred to or remain within the State Crime Command Unsolved Homicide Team for ongoing investigation, review and monitoring. Before I say anything, Sally, I'd really like to know, firstly, you were both there in the coroner's court. You had a lot of people show up for you. Can you just say how you felt about being there and also what the findings meant for you.
Well, it was a very humbling experience because I had asked people if they would like to come to the court to support myself and for mum and show that support, to wear some green. And so as I was walking down, which is what I would describe as a very grey concrete landscape, and then to be able to walk down those stairs and just see a sea of green was very humbling for me. It put me straight into a comfort of care and concern that people had for me and for mum and for Chris. None of the family were there. It was just Chris and I. And I've reflected back on that and thought, wow, if those people hadn't shown up, it would have been Chris and I and a bunch of reporters sitting there waiting to get the insight as to what's happened. And I think there was a few moments for me, like I remember the coroner walked into the room and the room that is bulging, people's even standing because they were sort of said, oh, did you want to go into the overflow room? And people were like, nope, I'm in here. I'm sitting in here. The look on her face was of shock, I think, as she walked into the room to see how many people were actually there supporting. I think it was over 70 people who had come along. And I think even Adam Castleton, who's the Crown solicitor, his eyes popped out a little bit too, because we were literally filled the entire corridor as we were waiting to go into the courtroom. So that was pretty special. That was a powerful move for the, you know, for any missing persons case. It's a powerful move to sit there and see that the general public actually really want answers for these families, and not just me, but for everybody. And I've always said power of the people, and that was a very good display of that. And I think that, you know, the inquest has been long coming. You know, it's nearly 3 years. This June it will have been 3 years since the inquest started, which is a huge journey to go through and to wait for the answers. And, you know, through that journey, I've been told multiple times that they believe my mum was deceased. And when we thought she was maybe potentially deceased based on proof of life checks and that type of analysis. And, you know, so to get to the point and actually hear the coroner say my mum is deceased, I could see for her that was, she knew that was a distressing thing to have to say to anybody. I can't imagine that's a nice thing to have to report to people. But she looked me in the eye and she said she is deceased. And that's very sad. It's a bittersweet situation, but it gives me an opportunity now to move forward with the investigation, because I've had roadblock after roadblock because my mum's still alive and well, says Gary Sheehan, and just didn't want to be found. So for me to have that said to me and looked in the eye and said, and also vindicated that it was the New South Wales police who did not do their job properly, is what she said. You know, from 20, I think she said from 1997 to 2019, the investigation was not done and handled properly. They did not follow policy and procedure. And she said a direct line to the words of, it's because you're in action that is actually the reason why Marion is still missing today, 27 years later. So that's very difficult to process, as you can probably imagine, but it gives me a power to know that my fight was actually real and I have been doing the right thing, even though others have hated on me and said I should leave it alone and I shouldn't do anything and she's fine, just leave it. I know something was wrong, and I've known that since I was 24 years of age. I'm about to turn 51. My mum was 51 when she went missing. So it's been a full circle of life for me to get to this point since my mum went missing. So we're on to the next phase.
Thank you, Sally. And I just want to say that the coroner also acknowledged you right at the start. And I was so pleased that she did acknowledge you and your family at the start, but also at the end, she said, and I just want to share it with my listeners. She said, I would like to acknowledge and commend Sally on her unwavering commitment and participation in the coronial investigation and inquest to find out what happened to her mother. She has shown fortitude, dignity, resilience, and grace throughout these proceedings. And I think that was very important to set the record straight, because you had a tough time when you gave evidence as well. And we will talk about that. But she also ended with acknowledging and recognising the person that Marion was. And I felt that that was a very important part of the process. Otherwise, it can become too process driven. This was your mother. And we should all remember that, that we are talking about your mum. And she said, finally, I'd like to conclude by acknowledging and recognising the person that Marion was to her friends, family and loved ones. The witnesses who provided statements and evidence at the inquest described Marion as a loving and caring person who had a fondness for antiques and the arts, could easily make friends and who was also a gifted teacher. It's fitting to end, as Council Assisting did in their closing written submissions, with the word shared by Sally to the court, reading from the family statement that she had prepared, in which she described Marion as a kind, caring soul with a wicked laugh. She was intelligent, she was cultured, and she had so many friends who loved and miss her still. She would always bring you flowers or a cake. She was a very generous human. It touched me to hear that, and hearing her compassion, which I feel has been lacking for you, and not forsaking the brilliant people like Joni and all of those who showed up, but you have lacked that compassion from professionals, in my opinion. And that is an important part of course correcting. For me, she showed some leadership there and some real qualities about her as a person and as about a coroner in terms of humanizing your mother and acknowledging that you have shown up every time, regardless of expense, regardless of time, to advocate and be there for your mum. And that's come at huge cost and expense to you, but I'm so glad that she acknowledged you in the process as well.
Yeah, it was nice to hear her say that, because I haven't heard that from anybody, as you say, from a professional level or from a level of I have it from the world of people following my case and supporting me, and that is amazing, but I haven't had it from that level. And it's important that we get that information, because it's important that for me that they actually acknowledge the difference and they acknowledge what is right and what is wrong.
The other thing she said right at the start, because we're going to talk about the findings per se, was that she laid out that this wasn't about attributing blame, that it wasn't about a criminal process, it wasn't about her awarding compensation, and that she could not talk about offences per se. She laid it out, that's true, of a coroner's process. And as she was doing so, I will share with you, my heart sank a little bit of wondering what was going to come next. I can see Joni nodding. And so I did wonder myself what the findings were going to be at that stage. And before we get into it, I just want to hear from Joni as well. You were in court supporting Sally. What was your impression, Joni, before we get into the actual findings themselves?
I just found it, again, a bit like Sally, of course, just very heartwarming that there were people that showed up, people that cared. I was a stranger to Sally before this, 5 years ago. And I just think it's time that us as women stood up and said, this is not good enough. This is not okay. And I think, you know, when Adam Castleton's walking through with his wheelie case, looking around, seeing all these women packed, waiting to go into the courtroom, and you had the court officer running around like a headless chook, if I must say, wanting to work out how she was going to fit all these people in, and the coroner opening up her little office door and peering out and raising her eyebrows with a look of absolute surprise. To me, that was a very good point in the journey to be able to say, okay, we are here and we're not going away. So, you know,
we're stronger now than we were.
Stronger now than we were.
Stronger than I was 27 years ago, or even 10 years ago, or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So we're here, and it shouldn't be like that, in my opinion. I shouldn't have to sit here and make noise, which is what everyone refers to as, you know. But clearly, that's what you have to do to get anywhere. So that has its own dangers and problems. You know, like I'm on heart medication now because I've been put through the ringer, you know, during the inquest. Your listeners probably don't know this, Laura, but I went to the doctor and I was reading my mum's sister's witness statements at this point. And I went into the doctor's surgery and they put me on an ECG, and I was lying in the room, and my resting heart rate was 194 beats per minute. And they went, oh, I think there's a problem with the machine. I'm just going to go and get the doctor. We're going to redo it. And it was the same. And they were like, whoa, okay, are you feeling okay? I'm like, yep, I feel fine. And hence that's where they went straight away, you need to go on this medication because your heart rate is way too high for what it should be, and you're lying down, you're not even walking. So that's what happens to the humans who are left behind, having to fight this battle. That's not okay, really. So well, here we are.
Yeah.
There are so many benefits of microdosing, and all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order, plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST, for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. And on the exterior, Sally, you always look so calm and composed, and you have navigated this very difficult terrain. And I think that that's just such a testament to you, but that doesn't mean to say the physiological response underneath. You're dealing with a huge amount of stress, and the process itself that went across a number of years, and where you were questioned almost like a suspect at times, put you under a huge amount of pressure. And I think there's a lot of learning here about not just the interest that people take in a case. I mean, The Lady Vanishes and everything that you did of your investigation brought everybody on the journey, but it's also in the process how you're dealt with. And I think it's really not okay that you were treated so badly when you were giving your evidence. And I don't know if you just want to say something about that, because I felt the coroner was trying to give a nod to the fact that she believed you and that you comported yourself with such measure and dignity and grace. And I felt she was trying to be restorative to you because of everything that you've been through, but particularly in her court.
It's such an interesting feeling sitting in a courtroom, and the very first time I physically got into court, I had Ella, my daughter, with me. She was 19 or 20, I think, at the time. And that was our first opportunity to actually sit in the courtroom because we had COVID, right? So everything else was live streamed, and I was tapping in through my laptop and my computer at work doing these inquest days that took forever. And we're sitting in a room for 7 and 8 hours. We had blackouts and power outages because the temperatures in Brisbane were off the Richter, and I was sitting there just dripping sweat. I couldn't see my notes because I was sitting in the dark, but they wanted me to continue giving my evidence while I was interrupted with other witnesses over the 3 days because someone wanted to come in and do an interview because it was that the time that they could actually give their evidence. And so my evidence ended up being broken up into 3 different days and not giving me or allowing me the opportunity just to flow with the conversation as to what's happened. You've got to remember too, they didn't take any statements from me until 2010. My mum went missing in 1997. So there's not even any references that have been written down. It's all in my head and my simple notes that I was taking. And obviously when someone goes missing, or the days before or the months before they go missing, when they're not missing, you're not sitting there documenting the phone call that you had with your mother in August, and, you know, writing down where she is and what she said she was doing. It's all in your memory bank, and it's not until something actually happens that you start going, okay. And then you give all that information to the police thinking it's all being documented correctly, and then you find out that they didn't do that either, and they just wrote down a few simple notes. It's been said to me that potentially it looks like note-taking was done and then it was written up at a later time on the reports that we've got from the New South Wales Police in 1997. So it's been a challenging time, but to be sitting in the courtroom and having Teresa O'Sullivan acknowledge me, it's hard when a coroner is a very powerful person. You don't speak to the coroner, you have to bow. It's not like you're sitting in the room having a chat. But for her to actually look at me on quite a number of occasions directly in the eye with a raised eyebrow if something was amiss, that she sort of went, oh, hang on a minute, that doesn't sound right. So we had quite a few of those moments through the inquest. I obviously got a chance at the first part when I think it was the second tranche, I was invited to give a family statement in the court, which I did. That was a powerful moment for me to be able to sit there and speak for mum and speak about other missing families and changing the wind, and let's try and make this, you know, use this example for better. let's do better in the future and make sure that no one else has to actually go through this. So to get to that point 3 weeks ago today, I think it is. Is it 3 weeks today?
Yeah,
to sit in the courtroom and have some amazing humans surrounding me in support there and having the coroner look directly at me and address me on multiple occasions and acknowledge the hard work and effort that I have done to get to this point, because it has been a mammoth task to get here. So that was an important part of the journey.
And it must have felt quite, well, I don't know if nervited is the right term, being nervous, but also a sense of excitation about being given information that could be very important to the next stage. I mean, I certainly felt it. I was doing a keynote presentation in Spokane, and as all I could think about was you and Marion, and I wanted to be in court with you and being able to rush off so that I could then live stream, you know, and I could hear for myself what was going on. And I didn't want to miss that. I would have been there if I could have, but I think a lot of people really felt like that. And it felt almost overwhelming at times. And I'm saying that as somebody who's a professional who's used to these processes, but I really wasn't sure what was going to happen on the day. But I was very pleased to see the courtroom was full of support and love and care and comfort for you. So now on to her findings. I mean, she did make it clear that she was going to talk about 8 specific issues. And those issues are laid out on page 5 of the report. I'll read through the issues. Well, one was whether Marion departed Australia on the 22nd of June 1997 under the name of Floribella Natalia Marion Remicall. 2 was whether Marion Barter returned to Australia on the 2nd of August 1997 under the name Floribella Natalia Marion Remicall. 3, the circumstances in which Marion Barter disappeared in or around August 1997, including whether her disappearance was intentional on her part and the possible reasons for her disappearance. 4, the nature and adequacy of the police investigation into the disappearance of Marion by New South Wales Police between her disappearance in 1997 up until 2019, including whether it was conducted in an appropriate and timely manner and consistent with applicable policy and procedure. 5 was whether Marion is still alive. 6, if Marion is not alive, the date and place of her death. 7, if Marion is not alive, the manner and cause of her death. And 8, whether any recommendations are necessary or desirable in relation to any matter arising from the disappearance of Marion Barter. And she took us through what she called the significant or the pertinent headlines. Now, what I heard from her were some very significant findings. But I want to ask you, first of all, of your interpretation of the things that she said, whether there was anything there that surprised you, and you can talk through whichever point you would like to, or all of them. I think the easier one that you started with was about whether Marion is alive or whether she's deceased. And of course, you've already talked to that and how difficult that is to hear, but it's something you needed to hear in a way to be able to then move to the next stage of asking questions. But the question about whether she left Australia, she determined that she believed that Marion Barter did leave under the name Floribella Natalia Marion Remicall, and that she did return under that name too. Did you expect her to rule on that basis, that she did think it was Marion?
Yeah, I wasn't surprised by that. I was glad that she went down that route, because we've done a lot of investigation into the flights and looking at handwriting and doing comparisons. I mean, we're not experts, but we have sat there and I've gone through and pulled out every letter dating back to the 70s that my mum's written to family and friends, and just trying to identify. And it's obviously, my mum's writing is a bit all over the place. It's not, when she's doing report cards at school, it was perfect. But when she's writing letters, it's a bit of scroll, hard to read. So there are key words in all of the documentation that link to me, to my eye, to say that is definitely my mum's handwriting. It's definitely her signature. Even the F. Ramakirk signature, I can see that is the way she would write Marion Barter, or she used to write M. Barter. For me, it was definitely her writing. There's definitely other writing on the customs cards when they're coming into Australia, but we've been able to sort of, you know, what's the right word? Logical sense it's because mum hadn't filled in that space and the customs officer has potentially written it in for her, or she's written that she's going to Europe and they've said specifically you need to tell us where in Europe, and they've crossed it out and written Luxembourg and spelt it incorrectly. So there's logic to what was going on with that, and so I was pleased that she just said it, because there's obviously a lot of debate even at these events we've had, people asking, are you sure it's actually Marion that came back into the country? And I have been very sure of that for a long time. I'm quite firm on my decision in my own head that she has come back. So I was glad to hear that the coroner was on the same page as me with that evidence and information.
We'll come back to number three, the circumstances, because I think number six and number seven about the date and place of her death, and number seven, the manner and cause of her death, she said that she wasn't able to say based on the lack of information. So that to me wasn't a surprise that she said that. The more difficult ones that relate to three and four, three, the circumstances in which Marion disappeared, including whether her disappearance was intentional on her part and the possible reasons for her disappearance. Now, in her sum up, she made it very clear that the circumstances were very troubling of her disappearance. And I felt that it was strong. It could have been somewhat stronger, but we'll talk about Rick Bloom as a separate issue, because there were some key things she said about Rick Bloom specifically as an interesting party in these proceedings, but she went further with Rick Bloom. But she did say the circumstances were troubling. And I felt that she certainly leaned towards this wasn't just Marion taking herself off and was living somewhere else, a totally different life, because there was no evidence that that was the case. There's nothing to support the fact that Marion is alive or that she took herself off and was living somewhere else.
Yeah, there's a few things in there. Like, we had the homicide squad putting suicide on the table as an option because they didn't know, right? And I was very firm that they cannot put that on my mum's death certificate. I do not want to see that word there, because I really firmly believe that is not what happened. So evidently they didn't actually specify anything. They didn't say homicide. They didn't say, I mean, she's referred it to the homicide squad, but she didn't specifically say what happened to my mum, whether it was foul play, misadventure. So that was sort of left as a bit of a blank. And, you know, I think moving forward, I needed to hear her say that so that we could move forward in the case and we can actually get to that next stage of investigation. It's taken too long to get to this point. I mean, if we wind it all the way back to 1997, there's a P79B form here in Australia that if someone has been missing and that's been missing longer than 12 months, the police in charge of that command area need to put in a form to the coroner's office to say this person has not been seen nor sighted, and an investigation needs to be done as to whether or not there should be an inquiry or an inquest into that person's disappearance or missingness. And that was not done. That was still, like, I've got documents in the brief where they're still chasing New South Wales police for that information in 2011, saying, where's the P79B form? Like, why was that not done back into 1997 or 1998? So there are big issues that sit there, and listening to the coroner, it was difficult to know that she was firm that it was definitely mum who went in and withdrew or organised to transfer the $80,000, but they weren't convinced that it was her that was using the Medicare card in Grafton. And in my head, I'm like, we don't know that for fact on either of those issues, so why would you say it was definitely her who took the $80,000 out, but it definitely wasn't her potentially who went and used her Medicare card? I don't think you can definitively say that not knowing the facts. We've got a lot of information that shows us little tiny details that put it in our head that potentially something else has happened there and there's been some sort of point of difference. Like, for example, her driver's license was ticked that it was a male, not female, and had the same name as F. Ramichael. So there's little tiny things like that that need a bit more investigation and a bit more, let's have a look at that a little deeper, because why is that new driver's license in the new name that my mum's obviously been convinced by somebody to change her name to that name. That name didn't exist in Australia. Nobody knows that name. There was no Google to go and Google, hey, what's a common name in Luxembourg? And it's not even common. There's like 103 people with that name in the world. And then miraculously, she has a new driver's license with that name, and it's ticked that she is male, not female, on that driver's license. So just little tiny things like that that have been missed. And it's not that Joni and I missed it. We've brought it up, but it has just not been brought into the mix. So there's still more to do, unfortunately, when it comes to that.
There is. And on that matter, yes, Marion could be a male name, and the initials being similar to Fernand Nicolas Remekal and the male tick, there could be something in that, couldn't there? The fact the coroner said that she was alive up until October the 15th, that surprised me to hear that. And we're getting into some of the detail here. And Joni and I had a chat about the October 15th, because that is presuming that someone had sighting of a female, Marion Barter. They could ID her, and she went in and she orchestrated that transfer. So there's a lot of assumptions being made, which I agree with you, Sally. You can't make one assumption in one situation and then say, well, I can't say the same in another very similar situation because there's no evidence. It was a stretch to me to make it sound much more definite that she was alive up until October 15. When we've discussed it before, that each of us felt, so that was a surprise. And I know a lot of my listeners were like, oh, October the 15th, hang on. Why does she think October the 15th? So a big question mark there. And the initials, I mean, we now get into the Rick Blum of it all, but the initials, and with Remekal, one of the questions I asked Joni was how many Remekals there were in the world, and you said 100, 103. I didn't ask how many there were in Australia. And the coroner did say that it was a highly unusual name. So how many Remekals were there in Australia? I mean, obviously, we've got one who's got the Queensland driving license, Rick Blum.
Well, at the initial stages, zero. So when I went to Luxembourg with Brian Seymour, we were having this chat in the car as we were driving to the real Fernand Remekal's house. And we were chatting about the fact that back in 1997, the internet was on dial-up, and it was a very new thing to the universe. So we didn't have Google searches and opportunity to sit there and check out things on the internet. That wasn't actually a thing back then, like it is today. And Remekal, as we said, zero here in Australia, and other than my mum, but the police hadn't actually found that information. And then obviously there was a driver's license that's been sitting in the Queensland file since 1988, so 9 years before my mum went missing, in the name Remekal, sitting on a file, which has been admitted by Rick Blum that he actually had that driver's license, and he'd taken the identity of Fernand Remekal, who is the gentleman we knocked on his door in 2019. Lo and behold, he'd taken his identity and created using an international driver's license to get a Queensland driver's license in that name. And that was the name that he used, that he admitted to putting an ad in a newspaper, the Le Courrier Australien, in 1994, which is the ad that Joni found, which opened this whole Pandora's box, right? And he admitted to using that name to create the ad, which is a guy who's married with kids, living down the road, had a PO box in Lennox Heads, which is 10 minutes up the road from Byron Bay, where mum's money was being stripped out of her bank account. And he was looking for love, friendship, potential marriage in that ad while he's already married with children. So it's a mind-boggling story when you sit there and just
when you sum it up like that,
talking about it, it just blows my mind.
Yes.
What I've got myself sitting in this bucket of, I don't know what it is, but I'm going to try and process it and work it out on the daily, so it's difficult.
Yes. There's absolutely no Remekal that's come in or out through Home Affairs that's been confirmed. So there's just no Remekal in or out with that actual spelling. So zero, except for Mr. Rick Blum and Marion Barter.
So that alone becomes even more significant. And I felt the coroner gave a nod to that by saying it's a highly unusual name. Well, it's not that it's highly unusual. There's only two of them in Australia, or were. One was Rick Bloom, and the other was your mother, who we now know is deceased. So when you put it in a population terms, it becomes really significant, doesn't it? And we're going to eke into the Rick Bloom of it all, because it also talks to what we're discussing now, the nature and adequacy of the police investigation. And I felt she said some very strong things about the inadequacy of the police investigation. And the detail that's in the report, well, yes, in her pertinent findings, she said that the investigation wasn't adequate. They didn't investigate for 10 years, New South Wales Police. She said that evidence is now unavailable because of that, due to the time lapse, and it's impacted the availability of evidence. And I felt she was strong around New South Wales Police. For me, when you go into the detail of the report, the only redeeming person within the report is someone called Detective Chief Inspector Brown, who said that, yes, in 1997, it was not adequate, that when your mother was reported missing, there was a policy that should have been followed and it wasn't followed, i.e. you only say that you've located someone when you have visual sighting of them, when you have corroborated that they are alive. And one of the things from reading the report, I really felt that where it had gone horribly wrong, again, she was very diplomatic, but it was still strong in her summing up, was in relation to Senior Constable Graham Childs. And this is on page 29. And he wrote, "She is a three times divorced woman in her 50s. And one possible scenario for her behaviour is that she returned to Australia with a companion and has transferred the funds to England to purchase a property there with a view to move to England." I mean, I can see you not shaking your head there, Sally. I just wrote down the side of it, misogyny. Misogynistic view of making a judgment, three times divorced, that's not relevant to include in a report, and a woman in her 50s. So the tone of it is about her behaviour, and that all of this supposition is just entirely that. It's just supposition. There wasn't any fact. And unfortunately, that's the wrong foot that it began on. And I believe that from there on out, everybody from Paula McKenzie, everybody who touched your mother's case, they were looking at these things that had been written. Sheehan, the officer Sheehan, who didn't do anything, 10 years go by and they're still basing. And that's why I always say to frontline reporters, to the responders, what they write on a report sets a tone forevermore of what goes on with that case. So she found that it wasn't adequate. And it was only DCI Brown who made it clear that there was policy at that time. And it wasn't just about the first responders for me, it's the supervisors too. The supervisors are there to supervise, but it set the tone. And unfortunately, that has led to the unavailability of the evidence that could answer a lot of these questions if it had been followed up at the time, which I know you know this. But I felt seeing it in black and white from the coroner, making it clear, and her comment about New South Wales Police not accepting their inadequacies and their failures, despite one of their own, who's deemed an expert, saying that they failed in this investigation. And I felt that in the report, she was very clear about that, and that she was baffled by how, I can't remember her exact words, but I think it was something to the tune of that it was a surprise to her how, when one of their own made it clear that Marion, you had been failed, that there was this resistance to admit it. Hey, lovely listeners. I'm jumping in here because I know many of you want to learn more about analysing behaviour and the risk factors for serious harm and homicide, as well as for suicide and familicide regarding domestic abuse, stalking, sexual violence, so-called honour-based abuse and coercive control. The good news is that I'm running new masterclasses, which anyone can attend, on the 30th of May, and then I'll repeat the class again on the 18th of October. You've asked and I've listened, and I'm really excited to meet you all in these classes. There will also be two different time slots on each day to allow for those who are in Australia and in the UK and America and in other parts of the world. I'm also running new domestic abuse, stalking and harassment and so-called honour-based violence risk identification, assessment and management masterclasses on the 12th and 13th of June, And I'll be repeating the masterclass again on the 30th and 31st of October for those who work with victims. Learning how to risk assess and advocate for victims, including developing safety plans, as well as ensuring you do appropriate offender risk management, is proven the most effective way to save lives and protect victims. And if you want to be DASH trained and accredited to train others, the DASH Train the Trainer will be on the 19th and 20th of June, and I'll be running it again on the 14th and 15th of November. I'm also leading coercive control masterclasses on the 10th and 11th of July, and the second date is the 4th and 5th of December. You know, these masterclasses really are life-saving and life-changing, and I guarantee that if you attend, you'll have many lightbulb moments throughout. And just to reiterate, the masterclasses on the 30th of May and the 18th of October are available for anyone to attend, and they will be virtual classes. For more information, go to my websites www.thelaurarichards.com, www.dashriskchecklist.com, or you can email Amanda on laurarichardspa@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing you in my virtual class, you lovely lot.
I'll give some clarity to some of that detail as well, because when she said nothing was done for 10 years, in the 10th year mark, they only did anything because I actually rang and spoke to the AFP, because I rang them and said, something's not right. My mum's, this is her 10th anniversary of her missing. I don't even know who to speak to at New South Wales Police anymore, because no one contacts me, no one keeps me up to date. And I'd like to know what's happening. So I stupidly thought that the AFP was the rulers of all and could actually come in and say, New South Wales Police, what are you doing? But they were like, oh, we can't do anything to help you. And then it came up at the inquest, and it's in the documents and in the cops log, that after I contacted the AFP and said, my mum's a missing person, I spoke to Rebecca Cotts. She was there working as a liaison officer for, she wasn't a police officer herself, but just working as a care and concern person about missing persons. She came up to Queensland from Canberra to meet with me and ask me if I would be the face of missing persons that year. I was 3 months pregnant with my youngest son, and they asked me if I would do that in the August. So this is in the January. I then put myself through absolute knots and hell, dragging myself back through all of the story, pulling it all back together again to tell everybody, getting ready to go and be the face of Missing Persons Week. And then I get a phone call 2 days before. So my son is weeks old. I'm storing breast milk so I can actually go on TV and do all these reports for this Face of Missing Persons Week. And they pulled me from it. And the report said that, and I was told that the reason that they had to pull me was due to sensitivity of the case. And then it came out in the inquest that in actual fact, what happened was Rebecca Cotts rang Missing Persons New South Wales and said, can I please get the file on Marion Barter? They couldn't find the file. So that's where you hear me talking about they lost the file. That's because Rebecca told me that that's what she had been told. And then you see that a constable came in, Joanne Williams, who wasn't called as a witness or anything at the inquest either, which I felt was quite an important part of this process. She actually changed Mum's case from being an occurrence to a missing person at that juncture. And it was brought up in the inquest and said, did you do that to save face? Because you've got the AFP calling saying, we'd like to use Sally Layden and Marion Barter's story as the face of missing persons. And then they ring up to get the file. There's no file because it's, there's nothing there, nothing's been done, and she's not even listed as a missing person as far as New South Wales Police are concerned. So they very made a quick decision to change it and then said, you can't do it because of the sensitivity of the case. To me, that was just them trying to cover up the fact that they'd actually done nothing and this person was still missing. And then you talk about a supervisor, Michael Pearce was the constable who actually marked my mum as an occurrence only, and then he said something like, due to work commitments, work priorities, we won't be doing anything until the person's actually reported missing.
Yeah.
And that was within 24 hours of me going into the police station.
Yeah. And even though there was actually an active warning placed on the case, placed on the in the cops events as well, to state that there was concern for this person and she appears to have transferred money overseas for no apparent reason. So there was a warning placed on the COPS events at that time, but she was still marked as an occurrence only.
Yeah. The whole thing was a shambles. And, you talked about a point in the investigation or in the case that really grinds my gears to the halt when you sit there and you read that she was a 51-year-old woman, she's a 3 times divorced, and she's capable of this behaviour. That's what they wrote. And then we've just had a missing person case that's blown up here in Australia, which I think is amazing to see that people actually get behind it, the media get behind it. Unfortunately, it's not every single case. It's still a pick and choose. Whatever case we need to work on, I think it should be the same for every missing person. But her name is Sam Murphy. And for me to sit there and hear the detective, who's an ex-detective, he was sitting there saying how, because Sam Murphy is also 51, she's still missing today, but they have arrested a man in relation to that investigation at the moment. I'm not sure, I haven't been able to keep up with what's going on currently with that. But, you know, the word choice for Samantha Murphy was she's a loving mother with 3 children. She's 51 and she's well recognised in her community. And I'm like, my mum was an award-winning school teacher. She'd just won the best teacher in Queensland. Queensland's a very big state here in Australia, and she came second in the whole of Australia as a teacher award in the November before she went missing when she left and stepped foot on that plane in the June of 1997, some, 8 months later. And yet she was deemed as, because she'd been divorced 3 times and she was 51 and was, someone said she was capable of this behaviour, and that was the lingo that stayed and has dragged on through this case for 27 years. So, again, communication and words are very important. They should be handled with a lot of TLC and care. You shouldn't just throw things to the wind and hope for the best, because it is very damaging.
Absolutely. And I felt that in her additional comment, she was trying, after talking about New South Wales Police specifically, in her additional comment, she said that I should make no criticism of Sally's actions at the time of 1997 and in 2007 or any time thereafter. There's no suggestion that Sally has in any way delayed any investigation by New South Wales Police or behaved in a way that can be described as anything other than understandable and consistent with a daughter very confused and anxious at finding out about her mother's circumstances at that time. And then the next line is around, I would also add that Detective Chief Inspector Brown gave very clear and useful evidence to the court about what he expected should have happened in 1997. The resistance in this inquest by New South Wales Police to accept the inadequacies of the initial police investigation in 1997 is difficult to understand in circumstances where a senior police officer has given what is essentially expert evidence on what should have happened. You know, reading between the lines of that, Sally and Joni, it just tells me that she understood their defensive nature, that everything was about defensive actions of covering their backs and their tracks and not giving truthful testimony and evidence, whereas DCI Brown did. And that's what all that you're asking, because I wrote right next to Graham Child's, what he said, misogyny. And I've seen it so many times, but it's almost invisible. But it's the age 51 divorcee. It's those things that are put immediately at the top, which tell people a very clear message. It's a subtext, isn't it, that's written. And unfortunately, that's what I believe played a key role here. And everybody thereafter fell in line, bar DCI Brown. And he's very important in the coronial proceedings. And I wish there were more officers like DCI Brown. And I just want to pay tribute to that officer for saying a truthful account of what should have gone on. And that's the only way that we learn as well, to be honest about what happened. So I felt that everything that was said about it's said in a diplomatic way that the coroner has difficulty understanding why there would be this level of resistance, but there was. I'm jumping in here to wrap part one of this illuminating conversation where you're hearing in long form Sally and Joni's reactions. Sally mentioned Samantha Murphy, and it's an important comparison. If a case starts badly in the police, in my experience, it often ends badly. I've said that a lot throughout years of police training, as that's what I've consistently seen, and I believe it to be true of Marion's case. Also, you can watch me break down Samantha Murphy's horrific case on Crime Analyst's YouTube channel. As Sally said, mother of three young children, Samantha Murphy, disappeared after she went out on a run on Sunday the 4th of February. She's married and her husband and daughter spoke out in the media and there's now been an arrest. Think about the double standards that exist where a man's philandering and or being with many partners is seen in a positive light, and yet a woman being married a number of times is seen in a negative light and counts against her, or she's judged and valued by the man that she's with. And in lots of countries, that's still the case, and we still need to challenge it when we see it. The misogyny and sexism is real, and I've seen it bleed out into many cases, always to the detriment of women. And yet men are given the benefit of the doubt and pass after pass. Also, the fact that New South Wales police are resistant to accepting the coroner's findings, well, that's deeply troubling. It's really not a good look and doesn't bode well for the future, particularly given the recommendation that Marion's case will be referred back to New South Wales Police's Unsolved Homicide Team for ongoing investigation, review and monitoring. And we have a lot more to say about that, and I'm going to share with you my analysis. So join us for part two of this fascinating conversation. Until next time, be curious, ask questions and always trust your instincts. Here's my final thought and ask before the episode wraps. I really appreciate you listening to Crime Analyst, and if you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to me. It really helps others find me and my work, and it helps with the ratings too. Crime Analyst is written, produced and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Jason Sheasley at Abridged Audio. Cover art and graphics by Chris Robottom at Syndicate, and music by Kilrude.